Good morning. This is the Artist Experience Radio Show, and we have a unique mission. We investigate the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners. Tom and I are trying to demystify art, making your art adventure richer and more enjoyable whenever you experience the visual. We try to bring to light the experience of visual art and folding our experiences into larger, brighter, more richly contoured surfaces, transforming vague awareness into definite knowledge. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it while you are listening, if you can. And you can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artisexperience.com, so you can listen at any time. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes.
Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to talk about an incredible art film, which is playing in some local cinemas. Since we believe that art is a metaphor for life, this film can touch anyone very deeply, emotionally, psychologically, and even physically. The film is titled Never Look Away. It is a German film that has received much critical acclaim, and it is directed by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. It was nominated for a Golden Lion at the 75th Venice International Film Festival, a Golden Globe, Hollywood Foreign Press Association. It was nominated for two Academy Awards at the 91st Academy Awards in the Best Foreign Language Film and Best Cinematography categories. It's only the second time that a German film has ever done that, to be nominated for two Oscars, the last being Das Boot, which was an incredible film from about 36 years ago. There are many wonderful acting performances in this film, but the film is 188 minutes long. When was the last time you sat in a movie theater for 188 minutes? The film is so powerful, you leave the theater not realizing the time went by. It is a movie that is very engaging. The movie has terror, suspense, love, joy, sadness, anger, victory, hope, and so many other emotions that demand the viewer's attention. The power of this movie depicts also a very powerful time in history and the history of the human condition. It begins in Germany in the 1930s and the rise of Hitler and the Third Reich, and the World War II years, the Russian occupation of East Germany after World War II, and the division of the Germanies into East and West Germany, one becoming communist in the East and the other one becoming democratic in the West. This history is the setting for a biographical novel, a narrative of an artist from his childhood to his middle 30s. This dimensional plot centers around the life of this budding artist and his trials and tribulations, and that of his family in the turbulent time in German history. This is a beautiful film, a must-see, but I warn you, the beginning of this movie is very difficult to sit through, as it depicts the callous horrors of how the Third Reich acted on their twisted and evil programs in sculpting the Aryan race. This has always been very hard for me to digest, and this film is no exception. The first hour is so very painful, albeit beautifully filmed. Sheila and I wanted to approach this film from the viewpoint that is specifically an art film, and a very beautiful one, about the life of an artist. This fictional artist is intentionally based on the life of Gerhard Richter, one of Germany's most prolific, rich, and famous artists alive today. What about the beauty of this film? Why is doing a show about this film so important for both of us, Sheila?
What the movie brings us is the story of the awakening of a young artist, Kurt Barnert. Although the names are changed, much of the story is the true account of the early years of the life of the artist Gerhard Richter. During his childhood, he lived through the Nazi takeover of Germany, the dislocation of his family, the bombing of Dresden, and then he lived under the communist regime in East Berlin. But he was always drawing pictures. The opening scene of this movie is of a small boy looking with unblinking blue eyes at an exhibition of modern art, or what the Nazis called degenerate art. He's with his beloved Aunt Elizabeth, holding her hand. This actual exhibit was assembled by the Nazis to demonstrate the depravity of modern art. The Nazi art docent points out the depravity at every turn. We recognize Kandinsky, Mondrian, Picasso, Otto Dix. His aunt is young and beautiful, and she whispers to Court that she likes the Kandinskys, but don't tell anyone. We find out soon that something is wrong with her psychologically. With the Nazis' regime effect on her, or her disassociation with reality, it doesn't really matter. She's taken away and sterilized, and eventually led to the gas chambers. This loss haunts us throughout the film, as it haunts the young Kurt. Just before Elizabeth is overpowered and pushed into the ambulance, she says to Kurt, "Never look away."
Yeah, wow, that's the intensity starts right there. We have had two shows on films, and specifically about the biographical films of famous artists, but this film is very different. We have often mentioned on this program that artists do not live in a vacuum. This film truly communicates how an artist is shaped by his family, his relationship, his mentors and peers, his country, and his world in search for a visual voice, a visual vocabulary that makes for a coherent and powerful body of work that is of the true essence of that person in the artist, and that person responding to his past, present, and future. This is one of the main themes of the film, and is a very important passage in an artist's life. What shapes an artist's courage, their hopes, dreams, the creativity to bring them to face his or her own being and essence? In this story, we are introduced right off the bat in the film by this early experience that molded an artist, and this is this young person seeing art in the museum, as Sheila just mentioned. In our story, this young boy seeing this degenerate art, the degenerate art that has been deemed blasphemous and useless by the Nazis, indelibly affected, literally and figuratively, generations of German artists. I think that's a very important point. Mm-hmm. Not just this young boy in the film, but many artists. Many German artists were killed, and they took their own lives. They were destroyed psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually by the Nazi campaigns against artists and degenerate art. This film has a very intelligent storyline, and it gives us one example of one artist's life and his trials and tribulations to this point. The premise of this fictitious artist, but not so face, here is where the controversy about this film begins. What about this artist?
Okay, well, before we get to that, I think it's important to reflect on this idea that the Third Reich was really a perverted aesthetic movement.
For sure.
Who would care that much about art? Do you hear our government talking about art? No. Degenerate or not, the uniforms, the parades, the rallies had an art director.
That was a Nazi.
Yes. Euthanasia of the unfit for the purification of the Aryan race. That was the goal. The Germans care deeply about art, and there is a Nazi aesthetic. Hitler celebrated only an idealized academic style that celebrated youth, optimism, power, and eternal triumph. We've had a hard time with this idea. We'd rather think about that art couldn't be used for evil. A Nazi aesthetic seems to be a contradiction in terms. If beauty is truth and truth beauty, as the poet John Keats said, then Nazis and art are mutually exclusive categories. Truth is beauty. That was what was written over the portal of my art school. It is the underlying message of Never Look Away, that in order to see the truth, you have to see everything in the world, the ugliness, which is at its historical height in Nazi Germany. And it also gives us the artist. You can't experience one without the other. That truth leads to beauty.
Amen, Sheila. As we mentioned before, the beginning of this film, when this boy is taken to this museum, this young boy does not understand why it is degenerate at all, but his aunt gives him a freedom, and I think that's mm-hmm. a really big word here, the
yes.
freedom to see, and that this naive and curious child deserves that which a child, all children deserve, to tap into their own imagination and creativity. I am sure many of our listeners can relate to this. His aunt takes him to the museum. He says, "Don't look away. Everything true is beautiful." This profound and very true statement, to me at least, is what I believe to be the foundation of the movie, and actually a foundation for thinking about life. Many ancient peoples believed this. Goodness and beauty were synonymous. Truth is inherently good and beautiful. It's biblical. Plus, on this premise, in the opening scene of the movie, this young creative boy sees so much to make one stray from the premise, yet this whisper by his aunt becomes tattooed on his psyche. When I use the word psyche here, I'm not talking about the boy's brain. I'm talking about his being, his essence, and to be literal, his soul. Psyche, which is an ancient word coming from the Greek, means soul. So it's just much more than the brain. There are other fine examples in the movie that enforce this concept of everything true is beautiful. Some of these examples in the film are traumatic to the main character in this boy, but for the viewer as well in the film. So we're going to kind of hook into his traumas. The thing about this movie that makes it so incredibly important is that there are many of these experiences of the human condition we experience, but we must have empathy, patience, and hope to get through them. In this movie, the audience bears great witness to this person in their place and time.
The filmmaker is Count Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. He's 6'9".
Wow, that tall, huh?
Sometimes it's 6'10", with white blonde curls and a baby face. He used to ride in a Rolls Royce to accommodate his size. He was born in Cologne on May 2nd, 1973. May 2nd is also my birthday, so that's why I put it in here.
Oh, goodness gracious.
During the Second World War, most of his family's inheritance vanished behind the Iron Curtain. The family castles were reduced to ruins. His family, which Donnersmarck describes as too cultured to have been Nazis, was uprooted. Because of all the terrible suffering Germany caused in World War II, there wasn't a lot of focus on what the German people suffered, which is understandable, but many people were apolitical, and they suffered too. When the war started, Donnersmarck's mother remembers that when she was 4, her mother took her children and fled to relatives in the West. She said, "Our mother made it an adventure. Women at that time, they were all heroes. They had the children. Their husbands were dead or captive, and the women were in Berlin. They cleaned up the whole city with their hands. They made a mountain where people go skiing now, formed from the dirt and stones of the war." You know, this is true. I read a memoir written by the American mother of a dear friend of mine. His mother married a German man who was working for the Nazi government. And when the war struck, they were separated. And she and her 2 children lived in Germany throughout the war. The women were all sent to the countryside, and she living on farms. At first, it was sort of an adventure. And then they were up to 60 people living in their farmhouse. They had nothing to eat. They were gleaning roots from the fields with less and less to sustain them. They had no sugar, no coffee, no tea. And after surviving the war, there was no functioning government. That's a difficult thing to understand. There was no order. There was no one to appeal to. It took a long time to bring her children home to the U.S. Anyway, Donnersmarck's father was one of the first in his family to actually need a job. He became an executive at Lufthansa. When Florian was 1 and his brother was 3, the family moved to the U.S. to Roosevelt Island in New York. We used to call it Welfare Island. It was an experiment in social diversity. Florian was so blonde that women in the city would annoy him by touching his hair, and he was so tall that his mother brought along his passport when they ran errands in order to prove that he was young enough to ride the bus for free. When Florian was a teenager, they moved back to Berlin. He and his brother felt like they'd been thrown into, he said, harsher, colder, and poorer place, and it was. All the American products they'd grown up with that they loved, which were sold in stores in the U.S., you couldn't access as a German citizen. Only the American military could buy marshmallows and peanut butter. He went to Oxford, and then he studied film. For a giant living among humans, his courtly manners was a social necessity, and they're also the inheritance of a family that traces its nobility back 600 years. Donis Mark has a booming laugh. He speaks five languages, including Russian, and has a whippet named Tsarevich.
Very funny.
This is funny. You may have seen his first film, The Lives of Others, which was a quietly eloquent film about the GDR's secret police spying on its citizens. It won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. It was a fabulous movie. And this, Never Look Away, took 3 years to create the film. And he and Richter spent many, many hours talking about Richter's life. Part of what makes the film so present are the details that I think must have come from their conversations.
The director of the film prepared Gerhard Richter about the storyline in the context of this film. Before it was completed, he was filled in extensively, and he was asked to chime in on it, and the director and filmmaker wanted him to be critical. But after learning the details that would be shared with this film, Richter was not so sure. Gerhard refused to see the film, as he felt it was too personal and he would be too emotionally affected by it. And if the film had strayed too much from his actual life, he again would be too emotionally affected. So he chose to stay away from his involvement in seeing, helping, or even viewing the film.
When Donis Mark, after spending a significant time preparing the screenplay, read it out loud to Richter, Richter was upset. He's refused to see the film, as Tom just said, although Richter has given a few reasons. You can only really guess at why he is so troubled. One thing we know is that his wife never wanted this project to go through, his present wife. But that didn't seem to stop him. There's an extensive investigation in The New Yorker about this, and it's really worth reading. It could be that Donis Mark made too great a link between the fictional Kurt and the real Gerhard. It's not a biopic. It's a work of art. Donis Mark said, "I will call the film something like a spiritual biography of our country." But the connections are obvious and impossible. You really don't know. It could be that Richter felt too exposed, or that the differences in his actual life felt like Hollywood drama. It is a film. Unlike life, it has a trajectory, it has a drama, a story. But clearly in the film, they are two artists with different expectations. And in this case, I think Richter is the lesser artist. You can disagree with me on that, or anyone can, but that's just my thoughts here. So I'm grateful that the film got made. And as Donis Mark said, maybe the film is for everyone else, just not for Richter. Some viewers are naturally influenced by Richter's objections, so my attitude is, so how is art not fiction? Did Michelangelo actually see Jesus taken down from the cross in the arms of Mary? Did Tintoretto see the gods in the heavens?
That's an interesting point there, Sheila. It's a kind of a gutsy comment because in some ways, the creating of an illusion in the history of art is fictitious. I mean, an illusion is
always
fictitious, right? So, yes. that's an interesting concept in the making of the film as well. Well, this such sensitive subject about a real person's life that's so closely parallels the fictitious character in the film that one wonders, like, the comfortability in even making the film. Like, you're really edging on somebody's essence. You know, that's a tough thing to do. But the concept is really fantastic in this film, and we get a glimpse of how an artist's journey and through life is in search for his voice. This is every artist's journey, and that alone is the power of the film. How do we follow this artist to find his own visual voice? In some ways, I wonder if this film is also reflective of the filmmaker's voice as well. In other words, his life as an artist. You know, uh-huh. That crossed my mind that somewhere there's a kind of subliminal message about the life of of this filmmaker who was torn from Germany, U.S., back to Germany.
That's true. And you know, his family also experienced dislocation.
So it's kind of another parallel. It's like three parallel lives going on.
Yes.
This filmmaker and life about the filmmaker are very notable as well in this excellent film, which Sheila has just so wonderfully described.
Well, Donis Marks said in an interview, and I'm going to quote him, "What I really loved about the story was how it was able to get at the mystery of what it is for people to create and where that inspiration comes from. That was always an element of what we tried to bring to the movie as well, to make it moving painting as much as we could." In the movie, the Richter character, Kurt, adores and then will later marry the daughter of the very same man who sent his beloved Aunt Elizabeth to her death. And this is true in the real life of Richter. Neither he nor his fiancée's father is aware of the connection. In fact, it's only Kurt's painting that will make that connection. And after so much trial and error in his creative approach, while he was truly searching for his own artistic truth, his paintings become acts of investigation. This is really the most, it's incredibly intense and exciting in the movie.
And the important thing about that, it's really kind of so much later in the movie, so you have to go through this historical kind of tribulations that the artist finally kind of puts it together, that in really he's part of this history, and then he expressed it. And that's a eureka moment in any artist's life.
Yes,
I mean, that, and this is the true life of Gerhard Richter.
Yeah.
He went back to this painful history to express himself.
And the thing is that you know it before he knows it.
Yeah, in the film.
You're being given enough information that you're sort of, okay, are you going to find it? Yes.
And that's the hopefulness in the film, too.
Yes, it is. They bear witness with frightening honesty, these paintings. At the moment when Richter's paintings reveal the past, it's breathtaking. And then Kurt himself, as he is facing the journalists and critics at his opening, he's suddenly drawing all this attention for these paintings. And instead, when they ask him where these pictures come from, what's the basis, he pulls a Andy Warhol response. He says, basically, the pictures mean nothing. I have nothing to say, and I'm saying it. And he's off and running towards success.
Yeah, I mean, it's that vaguity that artists are famous for.
Man. The art world of the 60s, they were reacting against the passion and the spiritual connection of abstract expressionism. So they loved the idea of detachment. But Donnersmarck and others have seen a deep emotional source for these paintings that began Richter's career. Donnersmarck takes literally the idea that Richter's paintings know something and are trying to speak the truth in spite of the author's denial. I trust Donnersmarck in his imaginative portrayal because the film is filled with detail that rings true. So we're going to take a break now and think about this for a little while, a musical break, and then we'll be back.
We're gonna talk about the music. I mean, which is fantastic. We've chosen for the first time to do the soundtrack for our musical breaks, and there's a haunting element to the music, but it was done by Max Richter. Now, I haven't researched this, but is it any relationship to Gerhard Richter?
We'll have to find that out.
I don't think so. Just coincidentally, the music. But we've decided to play these excerpts from the soundtrack because it really kind of parallels the film really beautifully. But we also want to thank our listeners for their generous and appreciated contributions for the WOWD LP Tacoma Park Spring Fund Drive. We couldn't do it without you and your support and your tireless work from everyone working at the station, the volunteers, and you, our listeners, have spent so much time and energy in being a part of community radio. If you missed our fund drive, you can go online at tacomaradio.org and press the donate button. Be generous and know we are the station that is very grateful for your support. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. We're getting back to our film about Gerhard Richter and the fictional person, Kurt. Kurt was a young developing artist. He was an art student and professional working in the communist regime. We see the socialist realist paintings come alive in the wet paint under his brush. It's pretty amazing to see that. I think that Richter's assistant agreed to become Richter in the film, and so you see him actually painting his work. And at first, when he was living under the communist regime, it was all about workers, and they want it to be all about the people, and the artists are supposed to be very insignificant. It was just that Richter was so good at this, so good at painting these heroic murals of the workers and the
social realism.
Social realism.
That's what the communist regimes in Russia and East Germany were totally. It was about the worker, you know, uniting the workers. I mean, that was part of their plan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he also learned. He also was put at first in a factory for lettering, so they could letter these communist slogans all over these signs. And he was taught to use a stencil for the letters. But Richter himself was so good that he could just freehand letter this stuff. So the other students were jealous because they're saying, "Why are you trying to make us look bad?" But he said, "No, I do it because I can do it." It was beautiful watching his brush do those letters. And so we see the stratified and strangled life of the elite professional in Eastern Germany, the GDR, and then the sudden plunge to the disoriented world of students in the Dusseldorf Academy, which was a hotbed of conceptual art. He actually needed to escape from East Germany in order to become the artist he wanted to become, even though he didn't know what that was. So here in Dusseldorf, it's the criteria for success is completely different, where skill in painting is treated with contempt, where freedom is elevated to the high place of worship. Every scene in both worlds seems excitingly accurate. We see how Kurt must find his own idea, how he experiments with different genres, materials, and concepts. And we are familiar with these concepts in American art at that time. And you can see there was actually one exhibit that Richter attended, which was the American artist, where he got to see who these people were, and then his compatriots, which were like Blinky Palermo and Sigmar Polke, they are his friends, compatriots in Germany. So they're all picking up on these trends, and we can see the art development in two different environments. So the eruption into his breakthrough paintings of the hidden truth of the criminality of his father-in-law is an achievement of Donnersmarck's imagination. Donnersmarck imagines how the intense, full, tragic life of a talented artist living through the two Germanies and under the patronage and patronizing domination of his father-in-law, how this life can, even while hidden, form the true fountain and engine of his art. In stating this, his true belief, Donnersmarck separates himself from the public pronouncements of his model subject, Gerhard Richter. It's convincing to me. I have seen many times a painter's hidden obsessions peek through his art.
Well, I think one of the things about this film, that since this artist is living in this historical perspective, is that he knows he has the search, but he's been deemed so many rules about the searching between his East German life and social realism. And then he goes over to the West and he sees that this conceptual art, you know, here the freedom is given him to him in an excess almost, and he doesn't know how to handle freedom. And this, you know, you just conjured up something that just hit me. Many years ago, during a Fulbright, I went over to teach at the art school in Bulgaria, and my whole lecture was on freedom and the expression of creativity in freedom. And I gave this lecture, I was showing how I could talk about spiritual values in contemporary American art, and a student raised their hand at the back of the classroom, and he said something that so floored me. He said, you know, you're an American, and you have a lot of nerve coming to Bulgaria to tell us about freedom because we've never known it. In other words, my parents were communists. My grandparents were communists. I don't even know how to express myself. Uh-huh. And it just hit me as you were talking about this. And I had nothing to say. I was totally floored. Uh-huh. That here, in some ways, when you think about it, in America, we've had so many liberties to find our voice. There are many avenues of discovery. But in this movie, he's stuck with this, either going to swallow social realism or not. And he couldn't do it. And even when he went to the West, he was flustered by seeing all this crazy art around him. And they really kind of chime in to a lot of other artists that were doing wild stuff in the 60s in the European tradition, of course, because they were looking at the Americans, and the Americans were doing everything. So it's, again, it's all relative to what your environment feeds you. And I think that was a very touching film, because I think of a lot of artists like us, Sheila, in some ways, that's one of those personal struggles. Where is our voice? What do we want to say as a contemporary live artist in this world? And the movie captured that excellently.
Right. Also, Joseph Beuys, who is a true conceptual artist from Germany, was portrayed as the teacher of Kort. And we don't really know. We know he was his teacher,
yeah,
Richter's
for sure.
teacher. And he invites Richter to his studio, or he invites himself to Richter's studio, because he's not known to care at all about what his students do. He's just there. And he goes to Richter's studio, and he looks at all his work, and he says, no, you have to find who you are. And that is the most difficult thing, because Richter, until that point, has been trying every single American trick, you know. And he has to think about it for a long time. And each night he goes home and he just is, he can't figure it out. He's stuck. And he goes home and he lies awake, and he comes back to his studio and he sits there in front of a blank canvas and does nothing. And this goes on for a long time. And then suddenly he takes out a photograph and he makes a grid, a proportional grid that we talk about, and he grids it up into a larger canvas, and he mechanically transfers the squares on the grid into a canvas. And so this photograph, or this painting of a photograph, contains information for him. And that is really exciting. And that's where he really begins to have his voice.
Yeah, that's actually the moment in the film that really kind of brings the hope through it. Well, I want to just kind of plug in here about Joseph Beuys.
Yes.
Firstly, when you're a young artist trying to find your space and your essence in creating a visual, to meet up with a professor like Joseph Beuys is a phenomenal miracle. I mean, he gave him license to break through that. And I think that's what a great professor sees. He knew he had technical skills. He wouldn't have been in the Art Academy if he didn't. I mean, he certainly did. But given that opportunity to have a mentor like Joseph Beuys was another freedom that he got. He was given he was given carte blanche to find himself, which, again, this artist never knew how to find it because he was living under these structured rules, and Joseph Beuys was one with very few rules. But I think in the movie, there is some fictitious stuff that goes on in the movie by the director here, but it's very clear that it's Joseph Beuys.
Oh, yes.
I mean, and I think you anybody that knows Joseph Beuys' work, and we suggest that you kind of research this because, I mean, he was an incredibly progressive German thinker at that time, and coming out of, he was a Nazi fighter pilot, I mean, you think about that, and he was just rejected. So there is some side plot there that's quite interesting and somewhat imaginative from the truth there.
Well, Richter is considered one of the greatest living painters. He's surely the richest. And maybe his fame and position is based not on his art, but on how much it sells for. But actually, I've always detested his work.
Okay, another dam here.
Or rather, I'd love to ignore it, except it's such a big deal. It seems to me that everything he did was a demonstration of how he can paint anything. Like, I can paint photorealism. I can paint romantic landscapes, nudes, candles, and color charts. And then I can do abstractions. His abstractions are really big. They're done. He puts big stripes of thick paint on the canvas, and it's huge. And then he takes this rubber squeegee, and he takes this squeegee and he starts at one edge of the canvas and runs it across the paint to the other side of the canvas, and it's this huge rubber blade. And sometimes he takes a stick and he kind of draws into layers of paint. Yuck. he said, I have nothing to say and I'm saying it. And I like everything that has no style, because style is violence and I'm not violent. Where does that come from? In doing his photographic portraits, he developed a stylist style. It seems to me that in the 60s, when it was the style of baffling the critics by saying non sequiturs like this, like, I have nothing to say and I'm saying it, just like the Beatles said, we're more famous than Jesus. Or when a critic asked Andy Warhol a complicated question, and Warhol sort of put his fingers on his lower lip and he said, would you ask that question again, and would you answer it? The critics just loved it.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's an interesting relationship between Richter and Warhol. I won't bore you too much, but it really is fascinating, their connection. I'll just mention the Warhol disaster series. Warhol did a series. He was, by this time, silk screening in his factory, so his hands really never touched the paintings. They're mechanically silk screened. And he did a series of car crashes, which are huge, enlarged photographs from the newspapers. And they're broken down into value contrast and then silk screened, so that the mechanical repetition of these images, which are so violent, bodies hanging out of the car crash. Ugh. But in repeating it and repeating it, the image loses all meaning, except that it doesn't really. And these were done in 1963. About the same time, Richter had his breakthrough when he discovered he could enlarge black and white photographs and paint them in a dispassionate mechanical way. And then he blurred the images, which was sort of his trademark. This idea of detachment was in all artistic forms all over the world. Saul LeWitt, an American artist, developed systems of art where there was no visible artist. He would develop a system like all the possibilities of some line or curve, and then he would have people do it for him. It was like a formula, and then he would sit back and the formula would be produced into a work of art. I think they're fabulous.
It's the formula word that's very interesting.
The formula
there.
Is interesting.
Yeah, it
and
kind
also
of detaches the mind in some way. I mean, in the creative sense. I mean, there's it becomes mechanical.
Yes. Yeah. There was a beautiful work at the National Gallery, but unfortunately, it wasn't stable and it fell over and they had to take it down. But it was a really beautiful result of that formula. And then the French New Wave novelist Alain Robbe-Grillet, he wrote a novel which was constructed along the lines of an absent third-person narrator. The narrative is like a camera, and it's recording whatever it encounters. So there's no person in there. And for the visual artists, it seemed like either a mind game for the critics or maybe a bunch of baloney, and to me, contradictory, because an artist can never really personally detach himself from a work of art. He's making choices. There's choices. I mean, Richter, he's making color choices. He's making the choice to do this in the first place. And why would you want to take yourself out of the art anyway? So here's this movie about Gerhard Richter, and I loved the movie. It was everything. It was, as Tom said, it was historic, romantic, beautiful, tragic. The actor, Tom Schilling, who played the character modeled after Richter, named Kurt, was lovely. He moves like a dancer. Oh, and to see him sort of doing his when he was trying to be Jackson Pollock, and he's walking over his canvas.
Action painting
like a beautiful dancer. It's a thing of beauty as well.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. But I find that it's very interesting, Sheila, that you brought up the kind of personal disagreement where the story of the artist was wonderful, but the art of the artist is not so. And that's an interesting thing. I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of Gerhard Richter. I think he's all over the place as well. But, you know, I mean, his historical framework is quite fascinating. Well, as Sheila just mentioned, the acting throughout the film is superb by all the players. The characters are very believable, and even as this difficult and multidimensional plot weaves, it's done mellifluously. You know, all about this art film is really maintains its artfulness, and I think that's really the key. The movie is riveting, haunting, engaging, and just plain beautiful. The tough subject of art about a person making art is worth a study. I mean, I don't think most people don't think about that. You know, they just think they create a masterpiece, voila, and it happens. No, but it's an incredible journey, and I think it's often ignored about most artists, even artists you might even know personally. The cinematography is amazing. There's these long shots of worn-torn landscapes, the pans over certain scenes. The movements in the film I found very lyrical. There's some repetitive motifs like sound, some gestures, and colors that make the film again more beautiful and create a visual cohesion. The color red comes up a lot. I mean, you know, between the sign paintings, the Nazi emblems, I mean, and red, the red in his paintings. I found red, of course, that passionate color. And then there's fire, and then there's facial close-ups, and then there are architectural elements, and these landscapes are exquisite. I'm really not sure how they did this, if there was some computer generation in this, but the film engages the process of art and the process of film analogously. And just like the history of humankind and the history of an artist, life is similarly analogous. So there's a lot of parallel things happening in this film, literally and figuratively, in the plot and the art making. One of the important things I want to convey is that we didn't really want to be too specific here on the show about specific scenes. We've talked about a few because there are other subplots, and this large film is really a marathon, and it's visually and musically beautiful.
Well, Never Look Away is a work of art about the power of art. The title to me says perfectly what the message of the film is. You have to look at it all, life in all its ugliness and all its beauty. Just this week, we all watched the Cathedral of Notre Dame burn. We watched the flames and the orange smoke billowing up into the sky and the collapsing of the spire and the skeleton of the wooden ceiling against the darkening sky. And the next day, our friend, Rodolphe, in Paris, posted a photograph of the cathedral. The walls were still intact, and the miracle of the rose window still shining. It's horrible and beautiful and sad, and it happened.
You know, thank you for mentioning that, Sheila, of this week's news, and it puts great and monumental into an historical perspective. Even disaster and tragedy, like we saw in the burning of Notre Dame, just like the film we're talking about, there's a lot of hope in this disaster and tragedy, which comes in historical framework. For moviegoers that are interested in historical references and subplot, this film will not disappoint. The turbulent years of Germany post-World War II, a little before World War II, and into World War II, the Russian occupation and the division of the German is clearly a backdrop of the movie that by nature of the history, it provides intrigue, suspense, and horror, if you could believe that. The film of the German cities like Dusseldorf and Dresden are beautiful and very believable. I have no idea how they did this. Well, this film, I became so enveloped in the action that it was very stressful and very discomforting. But yet you have to stick to it. It's almost like a passage. It's like one of those things you just got to get through.
No, I have a friend who told me that she had to leave. And then when we were talking about the film, she said, I need to go back and see it. And I thought, no, it really is it's difficult, but it's also worth it. So I know she's listening to this show and she doesn't need to go see the movie, Joan, you don't. But it really spoke to the importance of art and the way paintings reveal themselves to the artist. It's such a profound idea. Artists are notoriously bad in talking about their work. Artists are often obscure or ambiguous. They parrot the words of influential writers and hide their tender feelings. They do. Often it's the critics that give the artists their script. One example is Cézanne. You can't really believe anything he says about his work. And then there was the remark that Jasper Johns laid on us. He said, draw something, do something different to it, do something different again. As if there's nothing behind it. And there's nothing behind but the process behind everything he does. Well, it turns out maybe we've been missing a lot. I saw a photograph of a Jasper Johns painting, a very recent one. And he's never been my favorite painter, although I think his paintings are very handsome. But I love this painting. I kept staring at it. And when I looked more closely, there was a strange sort of drawing in one part. I kept looking at it, and there were figures that looked like Goya. It was like they were kind of residing there in this quite abstract painting. And it turns out that Johns was indirectly inspired by a seminal work of Francisco de Goya, The Sleep of Reason, in which the Spanish artist appears to be bedeviled by creatures that prowl in the dark. Jasper Johns created a suite of original works using Goya's demons as a point of departure to investigate his own state of mind and creative process. And it could be that we have all missed what Jasper Johns has been doing all along, because we were believing what he said. Just as in Cézanne, if you investigate his rocks, you can see his figures in possibly erotic positions in the rocks. It's all fascinating. Look closely.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of about this film. I mean, try to embrace the intensity of this film. I actually, I was thinking about it last night. I mean, you kind of felt like I was burning calories watching this film. And this is not frivolous entertainment. It's much more than that. So you just got to sit back and relax and see what happens. Have you ever left a cinema and you can't speak about the movie with the person you're with after you leave the physical space of the theater? And all you can really say is like, wow. I need to think about this, or say like, oh man, I need a drink. I gotta sit and ruminate on this one. Well, I believe this experience has only happened to me three times. And one, for sure, the power of the film The Deer Hunter from 1978. I also experienced it in Schindler's List in 1994. But Never Look Away is another one by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, and is one of those films that you need hours to digest after the three-plus-hour film. For Sheila, for artists like Sheila and I, this is just power in film. And this, the film is still with me almost 3 weeks later. It has a haunting quality and on an emotional and psychological level. The film forced me to take another hard look in the mirror and to think about what I've strayed from my own essence as an artist and what the important things that move me to make art and to be creative. Well, the human condition is very much part of an artist's life and is an important aspect of the film. And we hope that you get an opportunity to see it. This film surely reveres the hope of art in one's being, in society, in the world. The joy of the imagination and the glory of the creative soul, no matter how painful and traumatic their experiences might be. The imperative positive message of actualization, attainment, and even atonement comes through the cinematographic beauty in this film. And Sheila and I highly recommend it. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Sheila, talk briefly about our next upcoming show, possibly.
All right. Well, it's spring. And so we were thinking a trip to the Hillwood Museum, which has a wonderful sculpture garden, and we can be outside and see art in nature. Or we might go to the Women's Museum because we haven't been for our show yet.
Yes, and those are two great spring opportunities. Well, stay tuned to our next exciting program here at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. We have Bobby Hill with this music, with this fantastic avant-garde jazz from 10 to 1. Experience art and visual in everything you do, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
And you're tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.